Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to There Is No Offseason. It's BP's only daily dynasty podcast, proud member of the BP Podcast Network. If you have a minute, check us out on all of the social channels at Tino Podcast on Twitter, TinoPodcast@gmail.com, Patreon.com/TinoPodcast. Hit us up, give us some feedback, rate, rank, all that stuff. All that stuff is appreciated. We love you all, you know, regardless. I'm Mark Berry. I'm a writer at Baseball Prospectus. With me, as always, he's the fantasy editor at BP, and he is halfway to being able to lick all the trash cans in the land. It's JP Breen. JP, what's up, bud?
Just living that Pfizer life, my man.
Yeah, you're almost there. You can approach the trash cans, but you can't lick them yet. And as someone that has been licking trash cans for the last couple weeks, it's glorious.
Good, man. I'm proud of you.
We're talking about vaccines just to drop the forced code for anybody wondering about our mental health. Yeah. just wanted to put that out there. Of all the stuff that I just like kind of like talk shit about and make things up, we're actually going to clarify this one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, everyone has quarantine brain fog anyway, right?
Yeah.
That's all. So, I don't pay attention to anything.
That's great. Hopefully, you'll be feeling good and not suffering too many adverse effects, and being able to enjoy doing things a little bit more, not safely, but with a slightly lighter conscience.
Yeah, I was talking to my parents because my folks got their second dose about a week ago.
Oh, that's great.
And so I was calling them to check up on them, you know, the day after and make, well, I called them the night of, and then was checking up on them the day after and stuff, mm-hmm. like that, just making sure they were okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first night that I called them, you know, they're like, oh yeah, our arms are a little bit sore, but you know, we feel fine. And I was like, oh, that's good. And I was like, because, you know, honestly, if you told me that you were feeling sick, I was just going to remind you that you weren't actually sick and that you'd get over it in about 12 hours. So, like, don't really worry about it.
It just means that your immune system is working. So.
Right. And they were like, wait, so you were calling to see if we're okay, but you weren't going to offer any sympathy? And I was like, I mean, I just wanted to make sure that everything was going okay. But, yeah, I mean, you weren't, like, yes, you might feel sick, but you're not actually sick. So I don't know what you want me to do.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds completely unsympathetic on your end, but I understand the sentiment.
Yes. And so if you are wondering, Son of the Year award right here.
Congratulations. I know that it was a tough race, and I know that that's been something that you've been campaigning for a little while. So congratulations for finally bringing that trophy home. We'll have the banner raising ceremony, I would guess, at some point this summer. But yeah, there will be an official announcement, I'm sure, will follow pretty soon.
Yeah, unfortunately, it also comes with, I think, definitionally being the worst son. So it's tough.
Yeah.
Both the best and the worst at the same time.
It's a gift and a curse.
Yep.
So you mentioned calling up your parents. Mm-hmm. There are some call-ups this weekend.
You are a professional.
Yeah. I was hoping that we didn't stray too far from that topic to be able to use that one. we're recording this on Friday the 23rd, so the Twins are bringing up Alex Kirilloff. He was the 27th man earlier this season for a doubleheader, and he was called up last season for the playoffs. So he actually made his debut in the playoffs, but it looks like the depth chart in Minnesota, which has just kind of been ravaged with COVID with injuries, is now having Alex Kirilov in the mix. I think he'll probably pencil in at first base with Miguel Sano out currently. But we've spent some time. It seems like Kirilov has been around for a while, even though he hasn't really seen too much action. What are you thinking for Kirilov? He has not looked great. He was pretty bad this spring. I think that he was an odds-on favorite to break camp with the big league club, like they said as much. And he was just, like, really bad. I don't think that that's necessarily an indicator of him moving forward, but are you going out, picking him up, or if in dynasty leagues, are you just tossing him into the lineup and kind of setting it and forgetting it for the time being?
I guess in some ways, if you have held on to Kirilov at this point, you know, you kind of want to just get him in there and see what happens just because he's on a good team. He's in a mm-hmm. good offense, and so he could be a good accumulator. The part that really makes me concerned with Kirilov is that even though he has raw power and has shown it in the past, it's not really translated into game situations, mm-hmm. and the approach is such that it feels like he could be exploited by big league pitching. It actually reminds me a lot of like Ryan Mountcastle, but without like the actualized in-game power that Mountcastle has shown.
Sure.
But so like I get a little bit nervous about the overall approach and stuff, but like the BP prospect team still likes him a lot. They still mm-hmm. like the swing. They still like the ability to, you know, potentially hit for average and stuff like that. So I'm not going to write him off by any stretch of the imagination. I just, something has to change for it to be an impact profile.
Okay. So I think I have been higher on Kirilov in the past, and then just something in the last maybe this spring, really, like how he looked in spring, and I know it's spring training or whatever, but he just didn't look comfortable taking at bats, and so I understood the need to send him down to kind of clear his head, maybe if for nothing else. I'm wondering if now. It does seem like when guys get called up, their value hits a peak before showing that performance. I wonder if now is a good time to float Kirilov into some deals now that he's ostensibly up for good. Or if he has a Mountcastle like first 3-4 weeks, then it might be time to move him before the adjustments, and you don't even have to wait to see if he makes adjustments to the adjustments, and you can just sell high on somebody like that.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately it'll depend on obviously where you are in your contention cycle.
Yeah.
And to be honest, like if he comes in and has success right away, like he might actually just be showing that he could be good. so like it'll all depend on, you know, so many factors, but as we can see with somebody like Aristides Aquino, where he came in and just absolutely lit everything on fire and everybody was just pumping him up, and then all of a sudden he had a terrible September, and then now he can barely make the team and is on however many waiver wires at this mm-hmm. point in dynasty leagues. Like, you do have to move quickly. You do have to be willing to kind of make evaluations, make trades, and do all of those things as well, because you can see how quickly somebody like, you know, Mountcastle has seen his value drop. Dylan Carlson has seen his value drop. And that doesn't mean that they're necessarily bad, but you then see somebody like a Rosarena, who is excellent, and then everyone was just ballooning him up the the dynasty rankings, and then he's been, you know, fine, but not otherworldly in any stretch of the imagination, and now everybody's like, well, maybe he's not as good as we thought. And so you have to be willing to strike while the iron is hot, but at the same time, with young players like Kirilov, who have kind of the pedigree that he has, the scouting reports that he has, you do have to recognize that, like, if he does start off really well, like, that actually just might be who he is.
Yeah, and you mentioned Rosarena, and I think that that's a good shout. Mike, John, and Samuel were talking about him in comparison to Luis Robert this week on their show on Flag to Flag Forever. Great show, Baseball Prospectus Podcast Network. Shout out to the brand. But Luis Robert had that same kind of plummet in September, where that was the last time we saw him as a fantasy community, and we're like, I don't know, maybe he can't make the adjustments. The pitchers figured him out, and he's not as good as he was at the beginning of the season. He's like clearly good. Like, even if he doesn't hit 310 for the whole season, he's figured some stuff out. He's striking out less. And I think that when you, and to bring this back to Kirilov, I'm interested to see what happens with him, because we have so little to go on as far as minor leagues are concerned. I keep almost like whiplash making judgments on guys about who I like and who I don't like, and can they adjust, and is this the adjustment, or are the pitchers adjusting? Who's doing the adjustments? And it's just adjustments left, right, and I seem to fall for most of them. So in this full season, and with minor league games coming back in the next week, I'm interested to see in Kirilov as being one of the first big prospects to debut with that prospect pedigree and a full off season of knowing what the climate is going to be and what the environment is going to be. It's a long-winded way of saying, in this weird setting that we're currently in, on the landscape, like, he is the first test case of big pedigree guy. How is this development working? And is it different than what we thought it could have been heading into this season?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. And the other thing that I would kind of be paying attention to right away is where Minnesota puts him in the batting order.
Mm-hmm.
Like, are they putting him down, you know, at the bottom of the order because they want him to kind of like get his feet wet, not put too much pressure on him and all of those things, which might be wise, but at the same time, that's going to hurt his fantasy value early in terms of accumulation. And it also just might signal that he's up, and because, you know, he's better than like Jake Cave. but at the same time, it's not necessarily signaling a whole lot of confidence in terms of his ability to contribute right away and handle pressure. Judging by the fact that they brought him in kind of, I don't know what you would say, like right away, basically right away into the postseason last year, and they're like, well, mm-hmm. Here you go.
Yeah.
It does kind of feel like it's going to be one of those situations in which they just want to put him into the fire, but it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah. And I think that they are maybe a little bit better equipped to handle a prospect. I just immediately went, because it does seem like he might be playing first base here for the beginning of his tenure. And it just immediately reminds me of their divisional counterpart with Andrew Vaughn, and how he's just looked lost, mostly because he never knows when or where he's going to play. And so I really think that if they just kind of let Kirilov sink or swim, then that'll be better for him than the alternative, like yo-yoing, like Andrew Vaughn's doing in Chicago.
Yeah, and like so many people, I think rightfully pointed out the Tony La Russa issue.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something in which I kind of discounted it. And obviously that was probably foolish. Mm-hmm. But at the same point, like, we're 3 weeks in. I don't know. It's hard to tell. And what I will say about Tony La Russa is I knew him well enough to know that, you know, Adam Eaton was going to hit basically first or second every single day, no matter what. And he's never going to come out of the lineup.
Uh-huh.
And so like that, so I, you know.
You and Tony are one in the same in that regard.
I was like, put that in ink. And we'll see what Adam Eaton, by the way, has been really good. So I don't want to hear any Adam Eaton slander in kind of, I don't know.
This, yeah, podcast. No, I mean, so it'll be,
I was going to say podcast airspace, but I'm not 100% sure that's right.
Sure. No, I mean, I totally understand where you're going with that. And it'll be interesting to see what happens in that outfield, because Billy Hamilton was activated today, and Tony La Russa is going to have to make some tough decisions on where his lineup shakes out. Because if you have Billy Hamilton and you can play Billy Hamilton instead of Andrew Vaughn, you probably have to do it, right?
I don't know. I don't even have a good thing for that.
Well, then let's talk about Nick Gordon, who's also up for the Twins. And when I saw the tweet that said, "Here comes Kirilov and also Nick Gordon," I was like, "Oh, cool, Nick Gordon is back." And then I looked up his page and I was like, "Oh, wait, Nick Gordon is debuting." It just seems like he's been here forever, but also hasn't been. I don't think that we should expect like fifth overall pick production from Nick Gordon, but I do think in deeper leagues he could be a decent bench piece to plug in when he's in the lineup, because I do think that he's somebody that could steal a bunch of bases if he's playing and if he's, you know, hitting some. That is the question, like whether he is going to hit some because he's not going to walk. And so he's got the speed. He can play a couple different spots on the infield, and that's maybe where it ends with Nick Gordon. But I just thought it was cool that he's up, because he hasn't been yet, and he was a pretty highly touted guy for a while there.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens. I don't have too much. I don't have too much desire to have him on my team, I guess. But
our Slack was on fire for the Nick Gordon call up. I'll just say that much. Everybody was wanting to drop their 2 cents about the upcoming Nick Gordon experience. So check it out on the site if you want a little bit more in depth Nick Gordon analysis than from the two of us, where we say he could run some and it'll be interesting.
Yeah, I also just want to bring it back, because I had to look it up before I ended up saying anything definitively about Adam Eaton, because I feel like it's something that I'm required to do.
It always comes back to Adam Eaton.
I'm required to do it. He has posted a DRC plus he's been an above average hitter, so it's 100 or above, right, for DRC plus across the entire league every single year since 2014, aside from last year.
That's wonderful. I'm happy. I'm happy for you. I'm happy for Adam Eaton, and I'm happy for Tony La Russa.
I got him for a triumvirate. Got him for a buck in my model portfolio, man. It's good money spent.
Yep. Congratulations. It's working out better than my dollar on CJ Krohn.
I also spent a couple bucks on CJ Krohn.
So let's move on to some names that were on your stash list. What would you say? This is the version 3.0, 4.0 of the stash list. You've been doing some tinkering. You've been getting under the hood and coming up with some new ways to think about what we do and what we need when we're talking about stashes. Mm-hmm. And for your prospect stashes this week, there are some guys, and we're presumably past the date where teams will get an extra year of control for some of these prospects. So I guess congratulations to you 7 years from now, when you may or may not want another year of these guys, but that's neither here nor there. We don't need to get into that again. But number one is Logan Gilbert. And I think that one of those takeaways from the Kevin Mather incident is that he said that Logan Gilbert was on a similar track to Jared Kelenic, in that he would be up as soon as the date passes for an extra year of control, and or if he signs a team-friendly extension, maybe they would let him play in that case. I think that there's probably a little bit too much heat there's a little too much heat to just bring him up the day of, which I think maybe was last Friday, if I'm not mistaken. But I think he should be up soon, and he could be an interesting guy. And the Mariners are in first place, so What do you think about Logan Gilbert? Are you picking him up in any leagues?
Well, I mean, to be honest, I only play in Dynasty Leagues this year.
Mm-hmm.
So he's long gone.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah.
So I am not picking him up in any redraft leagues, but that is just a product of not playing in any this year.
Mm-hmm.
So in that, but if I were playing in one, it would depend on what's going on. I think in a shallow league, I absolutely wouldn't, because I'd want to be maximizing. This is the whole thing for the stash list, right?
Like, uh-huh.
I wouldn't want to.
You're saving the roster spot.
Yeah, I would want it somebody who I'm actually like using, and because I don't think there's any there like Logan Gilbert might not be up before. I mean, you could name pretty much anybody, right? Like Mackenzie Gore might be up before Logan Gilbert. We don't know. Luis Patino might be up before Logan Gilbert. There's just no way to know who's going to get called up when. I mean, who would have thought that your two starting pitchers who, you know, had started games as prospects this year were going to be Ryan Weathers and Brent Honeywell?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it just, it's so difficult to figure out who's going to do what in any given time that in most redraft leagues, it doesn't really make sense to stash. And obviously, going through the stash list, some people have been like, yes, but in extremely, extremely deep leagues or, like, only leagues, like, you kind of have to. And
sure.
Sure, but, like, that's always going to be the case, and most people don't play in those leagues. But, so, like, Logan Gilbert, if you've got room and you want to be able to stash somebody and, you know, if you're in an AL-only league, like, Gilbert, yeah, is one of the guys who's going up. But, like, I'd be also really interested if I'm in that situation, like, George Kirby.
Yeah, I was going to bring him up. I wrote the Mariners top 10 for fantasy, and I don't remember if – I think that Kirby is third behind Logan Gilbert and Emerson Hancock, and I said that – I was like, I totally understand why the other two are higher and the potential, and they're, like, big dudes, but Kirby was my favorite of the three, and it just – I think that we fall into a trap when it comes to comps of, who is the guy that is little and right-handed and that's Tim, that he could be a Tim Lincecum type or doesn't walk anybody, and maybe is a command control over stuff. I wonder if he could be a Shane Bieber, but looking at like digging in, it does seem similar to Bieber, and I don't think that he's going to be like one of the three best pitchers in baseball. But I do think that Kirby, with that command, it's almost like liking hit tool and expecting the power to come later. If he has the command and now he's being coached up to where he's throwing 98, like, holy shit, like, what else are you looking for? Mm-hmm. So I like, of those three, I like Kirby. And if you have the deep bench in redraft league, I would think about stashing him over, certainly Hancock. I wouldn't expect to see him this season, but even Gilbert. And I think that Gilbert's stock is probably the highest of all of them, but I would be more interested in trying to pick up Kirby if I had my druthers.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that Kirby might legitimately not even be up with the team until September.
Yeah. Or right? Like, or at all.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it's so difficult, especially when we don't really have games going on where we can't say, like, you know, so-and-so started off the year extremely well, or like so-and-so is on an absolute hot streak. They might just force their way into the roster of a team that is contributing. So like, things are going to get a little bit easier in the next couple of weeks once AAA starts. And it's one of those scenarios right now that Gilbert is solid, and it's hard to know what Seattle's doing, because Seattle just came out yesterday or today basically saying like Jared Kelenic is not imminently going to be called up. which on some level, like, I kind of get, you know, it's not that I think that he is not worthy of being called up or anything of that sort, but you know, you've got the Mariners who've got Mitch Haniger, who's been awesome.
Yeah.
They just got Kyle Lewis back. Kyle Lewis should be starting. And they've got Taylor Trammell, who it's not like they're in a situation where Trammell is a kind of prospect that you're like, well, you tried it for a couple of weeks, it's not working, I guess you're done now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Trammell is somebody that you still want to... He could be a slow burn guy. He might be somebody that doesn't really ever figure it out. Maybe you want to send him down once there's actually AAA games where he can play. You don't want to send him down just to the alternate site and be like, okay, well, now go be bored there for a couple of weeks. So I understand that scenario, actually, but it also might be a signal that with Kelenic and Gilbert, it's not just a matter of getting the extra year. It might be the Super 2.
Hmm. That would be such a bummer.
Yep.
Poor Kelenic.
But the part about Kelenic is they have a ready-made excuse at the major league level of why they're not calling him up. I mean, they've got plenty of outfielders, and actually they've got plenty of outfielders that can be productive.
Yeah.
And so I don't think there's any scenario in which Kyle Lewis shouldn't be starting, because he should be.
Mm-hmm. And so I think the question becomes more so, like, it would be justifiable as long as there's not an injury to one of... So basically we're one Kyle Lewis or Mitch Haniger injury away, or any injury to a starting pitcher, from maybe seeing either of those two.
Yeah, I think so, that's probably right.
It is extremely possible, but you also don't want to root for people to get injured, so...
No, especially for somebody like Haniger and Lewis, who have both really struggled with bad injuries.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Are just Haniger, trying to get back.
Haniger has been legit this year.
Yeah, he's been phenomenal. He's got an OPS over 900 and just hitting, 320 or something like that? He's just been incredible.
Yeah, not too shabby. So another guy that I wanted to talk about that you didn't have on the top five of the stash, but could see some time and could see some time at a positionally friendly position. Did you like that?
I like that? It. I like it. Like it's good. It's good.
Dalton Varsho.
Yeah.
The Diamondbacks are in a weird spot, and we were talking about this a little bit before we started recording, because they have a ton of utility guys, and so they just have the capacity to shuffle people around at a bunch of different places. And Varsho is like that a little bit too, in that he can catch and he can play the outfield, catch, mm-hmm. Quotation marks. And he was up last year for a decent amount of time. But he doesn't immediately have a place to play in Arizona, even though I don't think that they have any grand aspirations of being very good, even though they're just, hovering right around 500 like most of the league. So, Dalton, you have been sort of an advocate of Dalton Varsho before, and you had mentioned maybe trying to trade for him from our team in TDGX. Does he keep his catcher eligibility, or does that solely depend on Stephen Vogt's health and whether Carson Kelly is the best hitter that's ever played baseball?
Carson Kelly's been incredible. We were just looking up his line before we started, and Carson Kelly's hitting .351 with a .537 on base percentage. He's slugging .730.
I understand when he comes to the plate, you're just immediately like, the manager doesn't even have to flash the four fingers, because everyone knows you should probably be walking that guy. Carson Kelly walking about a quarter of the time, which is
he's amazing. Walked 13 times and he's only struck out 10.
Amazing. So Carson Kelly is not losing his spot. Maybe Varsho can sneak in some backup reps, but I mean, they have a lot of their guys are, or a lot of their outfielders at least are a little bit older,
mm-hmm.
that are tougher to displace. Like Tim LoCastro should be back from the DL at some point. And then you have Cole Calhoun, you have David Peralta. And then you have the utility trio, the Josh Van Meters, Andy Youngs, Josh Rojas, all those guys who can probably fake outfield.
And Kettle Marte can play center.
Yeah, and Kettle Marte. So I don't really know where he is going to play, but I know that he probably should, because yeah. I think that he's ready to be a big league player for sure.
Yeah, I think the only thing that you do with Dalton Varsho is, like, you wait until AAA starts if you really want him to work on his catching.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think there is some merit in that, especially if you want to say, like, I want him to take some reps over Stephen Vogt or something like that. But Stephen Vogt's still been not only just the clubhouse leader, and I think that's important,
yeah.
Is, like, he still is just somebody who can handle a pitching staff, show everybody the ropes. I would imagine he's mentoring Carson Kelly.
Yep.
So
are you saying that Stephen Vogt is responsible for Carson Kelly's 500 on base percentage?
I'm not saying that.
That's fair.
Yeah. I think that's what's really important to recognize, is that I'm not saying that.
Yeah, I've heard that Stephen Vogt is one of those guys that will just walk up to you when you're in the on-deck circle and say, hey, take these pitches and see if you can draw a walk. And then if you do it, then, like, look, it's Stephen Vogt. It's Stephen Vogt's world. We're all just kind of hoping that he blesses us with some wisdom.
I could see that if you're going to kind of be in a scenario of, you know, do you call up Dalton Varsho now? But at the same time, like, you also don't really want to do what Dalton Varsho did last year in the big leagues, and where he's, like, up but not really playing every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
So I just don't know what is happening with them. But Carson Kelly, by the way, is, I think, a good example of just the unusual developmental process of catchers.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, he was actually okay in 2019. He had 18 homers that year and everything. It's just, you know, his batting average was bad. And it was bad last year as well. And so, like, yes, he has a 375 BABIP and all that stuff. But, you know, he's showing the ability to hit for power. And when you're talking about somebody who can potentially hit 20 homers from the catcher position, and, yeah, maybe he hits 250, but, like, that's legit from the catcher position.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and similar note, like, Omar Narváez, like, there's so much more that goes into playing catcher, and that's why in the one catcher leagues, that's why I was just always like, you just fade catchers, you'll be able to find somebody that can not, that can be, like, okay, and not just be a black hole.
Mm-hmm.
Omar Narváez comes to Milwaukee, and we have seen what he's done at pretty much every stop before that in part-time action, and has been good. And then he has to get to know a whole new pitching staff in a new league in a pandemic. And then everyone kind of just forgot about Omar Narváez, and now he's the best hitter on the Brewers.
And, well, and the thing about Narváez, and I brought him up, I assume on here, I don't think I wrote about it. And just talking about his 2020 season and being like, yeah, it was a train wreck in a lot of different ways. But, like, if you actually look at what was happening last year, is, yeah, he was striking out a bunch. But, like, the parts that made his breakout in 2019 carried over to 2020. Like, the fly mm-hmm. ball rate was still there. Like, he still, like, his ground ball rate was under 40% for only the second time in his career. He was still, his fly ball rate was still up above 35% for the second time only. He was still trying to pull the ball. There was still so much stuff. His, you know, his launch angle was up in the exact same area that it was in 2019 when he had success with Seattle. Like, all of the things that the argument was, you know, in 2019 he found success, not because, you know, like, there was some kind of weird power spike or anything. Like, his home runs per fly ball were pretty much the exact same from 2018 to 2019. He just gave himself more opportunities to hit homers. And so if you were looking at all the changes that made him successful in 2019, they were still there in 2020. It just couldn't hit the broadside of a barn.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2020, it turns out he's making contact again. Everything else is the same, and he's having success again.
Yeah. So, long story short, catchers are weird.
Yeah,
they might take a little while to get good, and once they're good, they might not stay good, and then they might get good again after a year of not being good.
Well, so. And it just turns out that, you know, Omar Narvaez had a career 270, you know, it was like low 270s, it was like 273 or something like that in terms of his career batting average. And then last year he hit 175 and like, oh, look, that might not be actual. That might not be a real thing.
Yeah. Every single year of his career, he was like 267, 277, 275, 278, 176.
And everyone was like, oh man, he must be terrible now. You're like, well, maybe not.
So Omar Narvaez, Carson Kelly, they're both playing very well this year. So shout out to them.
Should also give another shout out to the old man that everybody tends to forget about, Wilson Ramos, doing the business.
I have almost just completely forgotten about everybody that plays for the Tigers.
Yeah.
So actually, I wanted to ask you, before we move on to some trade questions, you have Spencer Torkelson, and we talked about it a little bit, but you had Spencer Torkelson on the stash list.
Yeah.
And he has yet to take a professional at bat, so that might be a little bit aggressive. But from what we've seen from him in the past and his pedigree and his track record, it's not – and he has almost literally nobody in front of him.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't – it's crazy, but also maybe not that crazy. I know you were walking it back a little bit before we started, but what were your thoughts about maybe seeing Torkelson at some time in 2021?
Well, it was a combination of a couple of different things. Number one, my confidence in his bat more generally. But the fact that they were already trying to work him out at third base, the fact that they were giving him some positional flexibility, they played him so much in the spring, it was just one of those things that it was like they're looking for a reason to get him up in the big leagues.
Mm-hmm.
Or like they're trying to give him flexibility enough that he has multiple pathways to do it. And the spring, I think, put a damper on it, but when they designated Renato Nunez for assignment, you know, prior to writing the piece, and it was just like, God, you know, they just got rid of another piece that was kind of there in front of them. But yeah, I mean, reflecting on it, I think I told you that I was like, I think next week I won't have him on the top five. I think it's a little bit too aggressive just because he is going to have to shake off some rust. And the fact that he's going to high A is worrisome, and you know, we talked about it beforehand, the fact that it is high A, but it is still in Michigan, like it's still close to the
team.
It's
so nearby,
and it's what the Brewers have done with like some advanced guys, or like when they send people down to the minors from the big leagues, they send them to Appleton in Wisconsin, and it's low A, but it's close to the team, and it's like they've got facilities there, they've got support networks there, and it's like, we also want you close because like we just might call you up here. So, like, there's a lot of different factors. I do think that I was probably too aggressive on it, though.
So, just for some context, in that organization, Renato Nunez was DFA'd, so we'll see if anybody picks him up. It's hard to, like, when you get DFA'd from the Tigers, like, that probably limits your options of landing spots. I would guess that Isaac Paredes is going to be next for infield guys called up, and we'll see how he does. I imagine that he'll play at third base. Maybe they'll shift Jamer Candelario back to first base. So they have a few options, but after that, the cupboard isn't loaded with guys ready to come up at corner infield spots.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not out of the realm of possibility that we see him this year, but maybe it's just a little bit unlikely in today's we got to have as much control and as much timeline as these guys as possible, especially for somebody that could be a premium bat pretty quickly here.
Well, and it was also just one of those situations in which it's like pretty clear that like I can easily imagine a scenario in which Torkelson is in high A to start the year or whatever. has just an absolute monster 3 weeks to the mm-hmm. to the beginning, and they're just like, "Wow, I mean, you're we were kind of wondering if you were ready. Looks like you're good," and they can just give him the run. And it'll be interesting to see what ends up happening, because if they start to get all their young pitchers up there and they start to think about kind of building a core together up at the big league level, and we've seen it before in the past with like Kansas City, and that ended up paying dividends for them in the long run, that there is something to be said for actually growing a core.
Yeah. And I was just going to add to that, when your core has so many pitchers like Detroit's does, I wonder if that speeds up the timetable for position players, not to promote when if they're not ready, but if it looks like they're ready, maybe you don't mess around as much with service time because of how fickle pitchers are. And you're like, okay, well, we need to use, forgive the crude expression, we need to use the bullets in the chamber while we have them. And because you never know when a pitcher is going to get hurt, when they're going to go down and not be able to help the team. So I wonder if that speeds up the table for their position players as well, which would make some sense. But it does seem like the baseball is a little bit maybe cynical for that to come to fruition.
So if you had to guess, I just looked at WRC plus just as a crude measurement.
Okay.
In terms of worst three offenses in baseball, I'm going to give you a clue. Detroit's one of them. But where do they sit in the bottom three? And kind of who do you think are kind of like starting from the bottom and being 30, 29, 28?
Well, I have a little bit of bias, so I would think Cleveland has to be down there.
You would be wrong. I wondered if you'd say that.
The Rockies?
Where are they?
They are last.
They are rock bottom by a lot.
The Rockies bottom. Get it?
Yep.
So
it's real good.
Maybe Detroit is second to last.
Nope.
Oh, wow. So, okay.
They're third. They're 28th. So if we're talking about WRC plus again, 100 is average.
The Nationals,
Colorado
maybe?
Has a 70, which means they're 30% worse than the league average team.
That's not really what you want.
And then you've got Detroit, who's 83, and they're third worst. So there is a second to worst team, and that what you then went with was you're going to have to
Cleveland.
Remind me.
I thought Cleveland.
So Cleveland is tied with a bunch of people at 87. So, no, it's not Cleveland.
Oh, it's probably Baltimore.
Yeah. Yeah, Baltimore is at 81 overall. So you've got Colorado over 11% worse than Baltimore.
Than the next. Which... like boss, so I just got to the page. So Colorado is worse than the 29th offense than Boston is from about the 5th offense. Mm-hmm. I guess that's not crazy, but never mind. I thought that was going to be a bigger discrepancy,
like just some kind of like mind blowing thing.
Yeah, it wasn't.
I mean, it was what it was.
All right, let's move on.
But in case you're wondering, Milwaukee is tied with the Tigers for being a terrible offense. But at the same time, you know, also, it turns out that having Christian Yelich hurt doesn't help.
Maybe they should make the whole offense out of Omar Narvaez.
Maybe they should. Though Colton Wong came back today and already is 3-for-3 with a homer. So that's
okay.
And also, Billy McKinney continues to, like, Billy McKinney has another home run.
See, that's the kind of stuff that pisses me off. Like, you get Billy McKinney, and Cleveland is still running out these dudes in their outfield, like, for the last 3 years, where you're like, I don't know, they're just don't have any outfielders. Sorry. Dude, here's more Jake Bowers.
But it was also one of those scenarios too that like Pakoda called that one too. Yeah. Like Pakoda, like consistently for the projections had Billy McKinney hitting for power this year. And I put it in the stash list saying that actually, if you look at what Pakoda has, is their 50%, their 50th percentile projection, it was basically the equivalent of what Tommy Pham did in 2019, which was 20 plus homers. And Billy McKinney already has an OPS in the mid 800s, has three homers this year. And yeah, he's going to have platoon splits and that's kind of the deal. But at the same time, he's actually been, he's been good.
Yeah.
That's surprising.
Why take a flyer on somebody that hasn't really played when you can just be like, oh, I don't know. Ben Gamble, are you interested?
I mean, Brewers were, by the
way. Let's trot out Josh Naylor, or maybe Ahmed Rosario can play outfield for the first time in his career.
But if you are curious as to the team that had the lowest batting average in baseball, that would be the Chicago Cubs, who are hitting as a team 200.
Gosh.
Though I will say, after today's game against the Brewers, that's going to go up.
I think after, if you factor in today's game, that's got to be like 290.
They've got 15 hits through six innings.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah, it's not great.
All right, well, let's talk some trades. Actually,
yeah,
we talked a lot about how bad the Brewers offense is. Let's we don't have to spend any time on this, but Corbin Burns is just incredible. Like, I don't even know what to do. Like, when you're watching Corbin Burns, you're just like, you end up sounding like this, where you just can't formulate words because of how good he is. So I just wanted to make a mention because Corbin Burns is amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I told you that I was like, I think this is what Mets fans feel like when Jacob deGrom's on the mound. Where you're just like, oh, good, yeah, he's going to be great again.
Cool. Just a perfect pitcher. That's another one of these. That's great. Okay. Can you imagine when he gives up a walk, how weird it's going to feel?
It's going to be bizarre. And there's going to be like way too much emphasis on it. He's going to be really annoyed. But I actually was talking about it with some friends. And I was like, I do wonder if, you know, everybody's been talking about, this is something Tim Jackson wrote about on the site. This is something that Rob Arthur's been talking about, that the baseball's a little bit lighter and it's moving more. And for somebody like Corbin Burns that throws basically three different fastballs, he throws a four-seamer, he throws a sinker, and he throws a cutter, and they're all about 96 to 98 miles an hour. And basically, yeah, there's like some differences in terms of how he holds them, right? The grips are different, but ultimately what it comes down to is finger pressure. Mm-hmm. And you do wonder how much having a lighter ball that is actually moving more than we've ever seen in recent times is helping him basically just kind of throw four seamers and just change his finger pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Which, because like otherwise to me, I can't actually explain how somebody throws like a 98 mile an hour cutter. And like I know Klaase does, and I know that in the past, that like
Klaase is like, that's cute, 98. Yeah,
and like Jansen's done it as well. But like to me, they've always just kind of thrown natural cutters,
mm-hmm.
and that's just, it's been like, and that was the case with Jansen, right? Like he just kind of like threw a natural cutter, where Burns doesn't. Like he actually like manipulates it and has developed his cutter over time, and he threw one in college as well, but it wasn't this kind of cutter. And it's as you said, right? Like what do you do when somebody's throwing a 96 mile an hour cutter, throwing a 96 mile an hour sinker, throwing a 98 mile an hour four seamer, but can also drop a curveball and then also like will have a changeup at 90 miles an hour and is going to throw strikes.
Yeah.
The
answer has turned out to be nothing.
Yeah, it turns out there is nothing you can do. I'm going to strike out. That's what I'm going to do. Yeah, so it's been incredible. It's something I wrote about prior to the season that I was like, everyone kind of knew his rates were going to be good. I don't think anyone knew his rates were going to be great.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always been about volume because he hasn't pitched that much. And he's been pitching deep into games because he's been basically unhittable. But at some point, you do wonder if he's going to hit a wall. You're going to wonder if the Brewers have to protect him a little bit. Because at the same time, if this is not what he is, because expecting this yeah. is like unreasonable. But if he is an ace or a borderline ace, you then don't want to waste it all in one season, right? Like you need to make sure you're protecting him as a pitcher going yeah. forward.
Yeah. And for the league, if you sort it by minimum of 5 innings pitched, Corbin Burnes has a 1.78 DRA, and that is about half a run higher or better than the second place guy, which right now is Joe Musgrove, but half a run higher than the second best pitcher in the league, which is unbelievable.
Well, and it's like one of those things that's passed by the eye test. I was like, because yeah. I remember it's like both you and Craig that I talked about to in his last start. And I was just like, I mentioned, I don't even remember what it was. Like I mentioned something about a game and like, because Craig mentioned to me, he goes, do you think I'm not watching? I watch every Corbin Burnes start.
Yeah.
And you've been texting me through it being like, it's appointment viewing at the moment.
Uh-huh. It's a lot of fun. So, yeah. Shout out Corbin Burnes. It's so maybe my favorite. One of my three favorite things of this season so far. We'll get to another one of them here shortly.
Shohei Ohtani?
And that's the third.
Yep. Yes. I actually know what the other one is because, you know, we talked about it. So.
Yeah. all right. So we have a couple trades to talk about. I made a few in the new Roto League, which yep. it turns out didn't go so well for me. I will not be ashamed to admit it. Like my team just came out the gate and was like, Noah, we are going to be firmly affixed to 13th out of 14. And the only team that was below me for a time is one that is the team that just drafted all prospects. So it was a really rough start. And I'm learning that I tend to do better in the head-to-head or the points leagues. And so I'm working out my Roto thoughts real time, and I'm learning on the fly, I guess I should say, with this league. But I decided to do kind of like a soft reboot. I took Trout in the first round. This is the league where he fell to me at 6, I think. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not trading Trout because I don't think you can possibly get value for Trout. So a little soft reboot with the hopes of being back in it next year, or at the very least 2 years from now. And so I made a couple trades.
What if somebody tried to trade you Riley Green?
For Trout?
Yeah.
One for one? I mean, it would give me pause. I would have to think about it.
Okay, I was going to say, maybe you don't like Riley Green as much as I thought, but...
Riley Green might not be Mike Trout.
Yeah, so you made a couple of trades.
Yeah, so the first one was a little bit strange, I'll admit, and looking back when I was reviewing it, I was like, I think that I panicked on that one because of how bad my pitching was. And so I traded Kyle Lewis and Taylor Trammell for Dane Dunning and Jose Alvarado. Jose Alvarado immediately went on the COVID IL, and Dane Dunning has been really good so far for Texas. Mm-hmm. And my outfield was the only sort of strength I had on the team. And so I was trying to get a little bit more pitching depth, with that next couple of years of contention in mind. It was probably a sell low on Kyle Lewis, not probably, but it was a sell low on Kyle Lewis. I think that both Lewis and Trammell are, you know, fine. I don't think that they're building blocks, and so I wasn't really concerned about hanging on to them, but I think that maybe pairing them together in a deal, I could have done a little better than Dunning and Alvarado. I just kind of looked at how bad my pitching numbers were. Like, I just saw way too many ones, twos, and threes in the standings, and so it was like, all right, I need to do something, and then I haven't really been seeing that with Alvarado yet, but Dunning has been good, and so I was pleased with getting him, but I do think that maybe it wasn't the best value for what I gave up.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think unfortunately I think you came out worse on that trade. Mm-hmm. And like Dunning is fine, as you said. I was surprised you didn't try to do like just Trammell for Dunning, which I think would have been fine.
Yeah.
And that's just because I'm a little bit lower on Tremel. I think if you look at the top 500 rankings for Dynasty, I think you would have come out worse on that. But mm-hmm. I think you could have done a one for one on either one of them for Dunning straight up.
Yeah, I've been heating on Dunning from the beginning of the season, just kind of watching him and thinking that, like, I don't think this is the season for him, because I think that they're still kind of slowly working him up to a workload. So I don't think that he'll be going deep into mini games, but I like him as a long-term guy to kind of seek out.
Yeah.
Now as he's pitching better, the price is going up a little bit, but I do think it's still low enough across the market that you could get him without having to give up an arm and a leg. With you could definitely get him by giving up less than I did. Well, we'll say that. So the second trade I made was with Darius, and it was after we spoke earlier this week. We were on a little bit different of a recording schedule, and we had talked about whether Jazz Chisholm was going to be a Kevin Biggio type, and I was like, "Huh, I have Kevin Biggio. Let's see." And I wanted to sweeten the deal just because Jazz is awesome right now, and mm-hmm. Biggio is absolutely not awesome right now. So I traded Darius, Biggio, Yohan Duran, and Nick Allen for Jazz Chisholm, and now I have a shortstop instead of the three-headed monster of J.P. Crawford, Luis Urias, and Ahmed Rosario, so I feel a little bit better about that. And Jazz is just super goddamn fun, mm-hmm. and so I was pretty happy to shave a couple years off the average age of my team, of my starting lineup at least, and get a player with probably, or not probably, I think he definitely has more upside than Biggio, even if the floor is lower as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think I like the trade for you. And that just becomes evident in terms of like my kind of longstanding, I think it's pretty well established on Tino. I don't think I have to explain it too much. Like, Kevin Biggio is just not somebody I'm in on. Mm-hmm. You can go back to my call-up analysis on BP when he first got called up. I'm just not really on it. And so I would much rather have Chisholm, even if I think his... I mean, we've discussed it. I don't need to go into my thoughts on Chisholm all that much. Mm-hmm. But I think I'd much rather have Chisholm than Biggio, even if I do think that Chisholm still has average risk built in.
Yep,
but
yep.
But I think, you know, Allen, I don't think you're going to really miss anything there. I think Duran's actually pretty interesting. But mm-hmm. at the same time, you got to give something to get something. And yep. being able to basically buy high on Chisholm, you're going to have to do that.
Yeah, and that was sort of my thought as well. And Darius was, it was a pretty easy deal. We traded like two messages to each other and was like, okay, yeah, that sounds good. And so, yeah,
Darius is a good guy. I don't know what to expect on that, you know?
Oh, no, I expected nothing else because Darius is the best, but...
I don't know if Darius listens, if he does listen. I think he does, right? He's in the Tino League.
We'll listen. We'll find out if he does. If he doesn't, then we'll never know.
That's a shout. That'd be a tough one. But anyway, shout out to Darius. He's one of my favorites.
Or he could just mess with us and not tell us that he heard this, which would be funnier.
That'd be tough. So
I just love Jazz, though. So
I still think you came out. I know, judging by, I think one of the things that you should do when you're talking about rebuilding and the way that you're talking about rebuilding is still thinking about value, and that's important, but also mm-hmm. go for guys you like. And I know that you like Dunning, and I know that you like Chisholm. So I think in the end, you were able to acquire two players that you like. And you parted with a couple of players that maybe you sold low on,
mm-hmm.
but on the same time, like, I still know from talking to you that you're not high on them long term. And so in the end, I think that you're still in a position, I get kind of talking to you, that you like your team better in the long term because of the trades you've made, even if you think that maybe your value wasn't great.
Yep. And I think after getting Jazz, it made me feel better about the first trade too.
Yeah.
Because the first trade I offered and it was accepted pretty quickly. And when you see that, you always maybe pause a little bit and you're like, ah, shit, what happened? What'd I do? But I, thinking about it more, I feel a little bit better about it, even though I think I might have been able to squeeze a little bit more value.
Yeah, and I'm in a position in the league right now where I actually thought I was going to be better than mm-hmm. I've been. And I was, like, trying to figure out what was happening because, like, you know, my ERA and my whip, like, 13 apiece on it. I knew that I was going to, like, own the stolen base category. I got mm-hmm. a full 15 points there. My guys are striking guys out. I'm kind of in, like, middle of the pack there. And then I was looking, and I was like, I've got a 1 in terms of batting average. And I was like, right, all right, how bad is it? Uh-huh. And I was like, my team, as a whole, is hitting 208.
Oof.
That's bad. It's, like, genuinely bad.
That's, like, Rockies bad.
It's, like, pre-Brewers game. Cubs bad. And then it was, like, going into seeing what's going on, and you're like, oh, well, right, you know, Jose Abreu's hitting 220, Kyle Seager's hitting 211, like, you know, Lindor's hitting 204, Mountcastle's hitting .169, you know. I was like, Laureano and Yastrzemski both hitting about 200, Soler's hitting 208. Like, it's just kind of down the board, and every single one of those guys I would expect to hit better than that. So, like, I think that there is going to be some time that I can kind of make up some space, and I still think, you know, home runs and power and things, I'm still doing okay. RBI, I've got some issues, but I do think that the average should pull back. It's a bad hole to come out from. And so I'm in bad shape because of that. And the fact that Ketel Marte got hurt right away, that Tim Anderson got hurt right away, that those were my two stalwarts in terms of average, that was brutal.
Can I interest you in an Alex Bregman?
I mean, I've got Kyle Seager already.
So not really, huh?
That was an unnecessary dig.
And Mike Brusso.
Dude, I picked him up when he actually had, like, a couple of extra, like, really good games for me. Mm-hmm. Bregman, Bregman's good. I got no issue with it.
No, Bregman's real good. Like, if I had my druthers, I would just kind of be building around, hanging on to Trout, Luis Robert, and Bregman. But I think Bregman would be available in the right deal.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, Kyle Seager is somebody that I thought was a good value pick, mm-hmm. and I still think he can be useful. He's not going to hit 211 all year, and it's like, you know, we've also seen Brian Anderson is solid, and he's not going to hit .183 all year, and so mm-hmm. it's just one of those things that I'm trying to not overreact on a lot of, like, you know, Francisco Lindor hitting 200 seasons.
Yeah, I'd consider moving on from Lindor if I were you, but maybe that's just me.
I think that is just you.
that's just me if I were you. Like, I would take Lindor, but if I were you, I would not want him as much.
Yeah. So it's been kind of a rough year for the Roto League for both of us.
Uh-huh. The points league we're doing fine, but the Roto League is just it's going to be a long year, and luckily it's a long year, or else I would be embarrassed.
Yeah, and I would like to point out that in the points league, the two Brink team names 1 and 2.
Yeah,
not me, of course. I'm number 3, but
sure. Yeah. I mean, the Soul Skaters forever, baby. You know what I'm all about. So you mentioned this trade, this hypothetical trade that you were mentioned in, or that you had been asked about, and you wanted to talk about it. And I thought it was pretty interesting, so I wanted to maybe talk about it a little bit before we get out of here. The trade in question was like a juggernaut, a blockbuster: Wander Franco for Julio Rodriguez and Dylan Carlson.
Mm-hmm.
So last year, coming into the 2020 season, this is 3 top 10, if not top, you know, 5 or 6 prospects, all in the same trade. And I think that coming into this year, there would have been some, there were a lot of people that had Julio Rodriguez ahead of Wander Franco. Maybe not a lot, but there were some places where you could see Julio as the number one prospect. And I personally think that might be a little bit of Wander fatigue, just because he's been around for a little bit longer, and I wouldn't have him above Wander.
He's been around. He's been around for a little bit. He's 20.
Right, but he's been the top prospect. When you get to be the top prospect for like more than a year, yeah. Then I think that people are like, how long has he been in the system? But so I'm interested to hear what your thoughts are, because you said that you had a pretty quick answer and then were talked off of it also pretty quickly. So, talked off of it, but you,
there was a differing opinion.
Sure.
Yeah. Because I thought it was pretty clear that I would take the Rodriguez Carlson side like 10 times out of 10.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't appreciate how in some circles Wander Franco is like head and tails the number one prospect, but I do think in a year in which we haven't seen minor league games for 18 months and we are in a scenario in which we're talking about three top 15 dynasty prospects, I wouldn't for a second be willing to bet whether I thought Franco or Rodriguez was better. Like, I think we could be 2 months from now and either one could be the number one dynasty prospect in baseball. I don't think we have a real good sense for which one is going to be it. So I would, like in a challenge trade, one for one, I think that'd be super interesting. And you just kind of make your call which one you'd rather have. But adding Dylan Carlson to the situation, that ain't, I ain't willing to play that game.
So what was the, because that's where I would be too. We talked last week about how Dylan Carlson might be pretty good as opposed to great. And obviously that's still useful and that's still productive in fantasy and in real life. But even with that caveat, I would have a hard time not taking the two over the one. What was the argument the other way?
That Wander Franco was potentially an absolute superstar immediately. Was five category contributor.
Okay.
And the fact that, like, even best case scenario, Rodriguez is four categories.
Without stolen bases?
Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense.
And again, like, I think I could see that argument if I had a real sense that that Franco was that much better than Rodriguez.
Yeah.
But like, I don't see a scenario in which I don't think I could make that call or feel comfortable making that call in any capacity.
I would have difficulty projecting like other world superstar status. If that makes sense. Like
for whom? For anyone?
For anyone, really. Yeah. Like you're making a bet that this person is going to be like one of the three or four best hitters in fantasy.
Yeah.
And that's a very small group to be in. Like you have MVPs and, you know, multiple time all-stars that can't crack that list. So I think it would be really tough to just be like, yeah, he's going to be that.
Yeah. And so I think it's going to be, we've been talking about it all year, but like we're going to see so much volatility when it comes to minor league prospect valuations that I wouldn't be willing to make any trades on that basis right now.
I'm really excited about it.
Yeah. I'm excited to overreact.
That's what I'm saying. Like I cannot wait until we get to see some like big swings in prospect rankings.
Yeah, man. Let's have just absolutely someone, you know, random mid-tier guy like Travis Swaggerty go out and hit like 450 for the first 2 weeks and everyone is like, he is incredible.
Is the Pirates timeline moved up by 3 years Travis Swaggerty?
Because Travis Swaggerty absolutely like hits. And then like, you know, Kirilloff struggles for a little bit and Larnach goes out and hits like 350 with five homers in the first 7 days and everyone's like, did they make the wrong call? And you're like, I don't know, maybe.
It's going to be great.
Looking forward to it.
I'm excited. Well, you know where to hear about all of those overreactions and all of that, you know, projection, all of those big swings. And it's right here. It's with your favorite Tino 2.0 podcast voices. It's with us. So check us out next week. We'll be back. Hopefully we'll have some minor league games to overreact to. And if we do, it'll only be one or two games, so it'll be even more fun to overreact. Stay safe, everybody. Thanks for listening. You guys are the coolest. See ya.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.